WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The next few minutes are going to be most enjoyable for basketball fans, but I think a lot of people are going to actually enjoy this conversation and might very well enjoy the book that we're going to be talking about, a book called Dynasties, The 10 GOAT Teams That Changed the NBA Forever. And, of course, by GOAT, we mean greatest of all time, the 10 greatest of all time teams that changed the NBA forever. This is a look at some of the most important dynasties and the players who were particularly significant in those dynasties. And the book is also an opportunity to reflect upon the place that powerful NBA dynasties have in the pantheon of professional basketball, and the way in which some of the most important dynasties in basketball history have played a really important role in elevating the significance of the NBA on the American cultural landscape. The book is written by Marcus Thompson II, who is a lead columnist at The Athletic, and he has written in particular about pro sports in the San Francisco, Oakland area. And he's responsible for the best-selling book Golden, The Miraculous Rise of Steph Curry, and KD, Kevin Durant's Relentless Pursuit to Be the Greatest. And this book is published by Black Dog and Leventhal Publishers. Again, it's titled Dynasties. Marcus Thompson II, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Did you come up with the description of the book? That's way better than what I came up with. That was stellar.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed the book, and I want to say, too, I'm not actually the most diehard of basketball fans, although I have to say I watched with escalating interest and at the end was absolutely thrilled when our nearby Milwaukee Bucks claimed the world championship. So I guess I find myself riveted to the NBA now in a way that I maybe wasn't before. But even as someone not rabidly interested in professional basketball, I just found this book really, really captivating. I really loved it, and I'm excited to talk with you about it. Ahead of us exploring the book, I would love to know a little bit about your own relationship to the world of sports. And did all of this begin for you as an athlete yourself? And then at what point did you find yourself wanting to write about athletics? Or did you not come from this as a former athlete yourself?
Well, you know, I found writing about sports as I found it because I wasn't very good, and I learned that early. I was in high school, and I was playing varsity basketball, and I was one of those guys who only got in the game when it was a blowout. And so I ended up, you know, that was my moment where I was like, you know what, I'm probably not going anywhere in basketball. So I signed up for the high school newspaper so I could write about my friends who were actually good at basketball.
Is that where you really began your work as a writer? I mean, is that some of the first serious writing that you did?
Actually, I had it in Milwaukee. So I was messing around with the high school paper. It was fun. It's where I learned about it. And then I went to college in Atlanta, but I did the internship at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Wow.
And it was just one of the most engaging. It was just so much fun. Gary Howard was the sports editor, And I hopped around. I went to Packers training camp. I was, you know, obviously did a lot of Brewers. I did some Buck stories around the draft, and it just covering professional sports. I even did an Indy race covering professional sports. I was hooked, and that's where I kind of felt the big time element of it and how you could be right in the mix. So I got hooked in Milwaukee when I realized, this is exactly what I want to do. And it was great. I had a blast. And it's taken off since then. That was 1998 when I did that internship.
Wow. Well, I'm happy to learn of that connection with Milwaukee. That's absolutely terrific. So when you find yourself writing about particular teams that are, kind of part of your beat, for instance, the teams that are right there in the San Francisco, Oakland area, what do you do with what might be your own personal preferences? I mean, those players that you especially like, or those teams you especially like or are rooting for, versus your responsibility as a sports writer to perhaps put some of that aside, maybe not all of those feelings aside. I mean, how do you sort that out in terms of the professional and the personal?
I actually found it sorted itself out. For me, number one, the adrenaline, the passion of chasing a story, getting a story, of executing a story, to me it was just greater than the fandom of sports, right? I cared more about that. At the end of a game, I'm much more concerned about the machinations behind the scenes I'm much more want to know about what happened and what's happening now than the result. I'm just drawn to the storyline. So I ended up finding that more appealing anyway. But, as a journalist, the team kind of helps with that because, we're trying to find information. They're trying to prevent us from finding certain information. And the natural enmity between the two, goals, kind of gets rid of the fan part, right? I grew up a Warriors fan. My dad and I used to, die hard into the Warriors. But after years of, clashing with the Warriors in pursuit of information to try to get stories, you just lose that a bit, right? You lose that care about what happens with the team, and you realize I have a job to do. They make you a professional because they're literally in the way of you trying to do your job. So it's easier than what I thought it would be. It's much easier than what I thought it'd be. And I find that people who do keep that fandom, it usually manifests in a negative way, right? You want to make sure people know that you're not out here rooting or you're not biased. So you're especially hard on the team. It usually works that way from my experience, where you want to be extra critical just to make sure the lines aren't blurred.
I also want to ask you briefly about the COVID-19 pandemic. And, of course, at its worst, the pandemic had a devastating effect on so many sectors of our society, including the performing arts and professional sports and education and all kinds of other sectors. How did you feel the impact yourself as a sports writer when you suddenly found the beat that you were covering, in a sense, evaporating before your eyes? What was that like?
It was highly stressful. It was incredibly emotional. It was worrisome. You just didn't know. I had to start planning for what happens if this goes away. What do I do now? It was on top of the life stressors that came with it, right? Having family members to be concerned about. I have a daughter who essentially was stuck at home because the schools were closed. So I was also a third grade teacher. she was an eighth grade teacher. So this idea of, hey man, this might be it, it was a daunting thought, exercise and figuring out what to do. We tried to stay afloat, and I definitely gained an appreciation for access, for being there, for being able to talk to people, for having questions and having the kind of freedom to go find the answer, all right, and not do it all via text message and phone calls and hoping people return them. So I definitely gained a special appreciation for being there. But I must admit, I also lost a little bit of the, you know, the grandeur. Sports definitely found its rightful place as less important. I even now find myself chasing stories that are less about sports and more about, like, humanity and people and the kind of important underlining elements that make sports such a draw. So it did lose a bit of its luster, a bit of its urgency, because it's sports, right? And there, I still have people in my family dealing with the pandemic and the fallout from it. So it was, 2020 was incredibly tough. It was one of the hardest years of my life. And 2021 was marginally better. But, it was definitely weird when the entire thing is, our whole focus is a documentary about the Bulls from 98, right? It's like, that's all we had. And the rest was kind of making up stuff.
Fascinating. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Marcus Thompson II, and we're talking about his most recent book. It's a book titled Dynasties, and it examines the legacy and impact of the 10 greatest teams of all time in NBA history. And we'll examine some of those dynasties in just a moment. I sure want to ask you about a couple of provocative things you say in the opening chapter of the book, which is called Dynasties Matter. And wow, you open with such an interesting opening sentence. The NBA's special sauce is hatred. And you go on to explain what you mean, but I want to hear it in your own words. Explain why there is at the heart of kind of the most fervent kind of fandom for the NBA a sort of special brand of hatred that is in the mix.
Yeah, it's the opposite of the negative part of the rivalry, right? It's the desire to see a team fail as much as it is to see your team succeed. I remember being a kid in Oakland, and the Warriors were terrible, right? This is before the Warriors were good. They were terrible, perennially terrible. They never made the playoffs. So as you know, you end up watching other things. And I remember being just completely fascinated by the Lakers Celtics. I mean, completely fascinated. And here was this kid in Oakland who doesn't really have a dog in either fight, was just completely drawn to the tension. And to me, that is a unique element in the NBA. It's almost a required element. It's a relatively young sport. It doesn't have the history of baseball. It's not completely based on regions and cities in the way that the NFL is. The NBA has kind of thrived and lived off of the tension of somebody being so great that they inspire, enemies, right? They're so great that they become an antagonist as well as a protagonist. And the NBA took off with Magic and Bird, and a lot of that has to do with the clash of the cultures and ideologies of Boston and L.A., Northeast and Hollywood, black and white, right? It's this, the tension. And it's so magnetic. It's so, like, dramatic that it just draws people. It draws casual fans. So, to me, the NBA flourishes when it has that kind of greatness. I remember as a kid, I did not understand how people could not like Michael Jordan. I was such a Michael Jordan nutcase, like it was over. It was everything, shoes, all of that, right? I watched all the VHS tapes, and I just couldn't believe when people would say they didn't like Jordan. But like you growing up and you learning how it works, it's like, you know, Jordan is so great. He's probably torched some people, right? He's taken hope from a lot of people, and that isn't a great experience for the people he's taking hope from. Like I can imagine Utah didn't like Jordan very much after taking two titles from him. But then you start understanding, like, this is why this guy is so huge, because he has people who love him, and he also has people who can't stand him and want to see him fail. And it ends up being like a moth to a flame.
Right. It's a kind of greatness that almost inevitably generates resentment and resentment that can sometimes build itself all the way up to what feels like a kind of hatred.
Yes. Right.
Also in this chapter,
not real hate, but
right. Yeah, it's not hatred in, you know, in sort of its purest sense, but something related, maybe a first cousin. This chapter also explores in some specifics in terms of how this first great rivalry of Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, how that really helped galvanize a new era for the NBA, particularly when it came to things like ratings. Just tell us just how dramatic a shift or change we're talking about here.
We're talking about the NBA Finals being tape delayed in favor of Dallas reruns. Remember the show Dallas and Who Shot JR? That was more valuable to TV stations to play instead of the NBA. Magic Johnson's very first major moment was when he got he played all five positions and had 40 points and when Kareem was out, and they won the 1980 NBA Finals, and it was on tape delay. Basketball, for most of its existence, has been a second-tier sport, a junior varsity sport of sorts. Again, it doesn't have the history of baseball, the NFL. Its origins begin in cages as this kind of like grimy, sarcastically physical sport, because, you know, they played in cages and people called them cagers, and it took them a while. It wasn't this beautiful, graceful game about athleticism. It wasn't that. So the NBA had to kind of claw for the place it had. And it was Magic and Bird that galvanized the country. They did it first in college basketball, which is what people cared more about, was college. And even AAU was bigger than pro basketball. But they galvanized them in college and took that intense rivalry to the pros. And what it did was it took two huge major markets and got them interested in the NBA. And then it took this kind of cultural clash, and it got that played out in the NBA. So what it did was bring just so many people, and now you got all these new eyes appreciating the sport. That's why I appreciate what you said at the beginning, how you aren't really this diehard NBA fan. But Giannis is so good that how do you not follow this guy, right? Like, how do you not do that? And if you follow Giannis, you know he's so good that he has people who really, for some odd reason, finds a way to deride him, right? Even if it's James Harden saying, all he can do is dunk, right? It's like, are you watching the game? It's incredible. But he's so great that he makes people who don't pay attention, pay attention. And that's what Magic and Bird did. They were so good, like, as individually, but mostly as a class duo. They were so riveting and dramatic that they made people pay attention.
Right.
And they turned the NBA into like a varsity league, right? They were JV before. Magic and Bird elevated them to varsity.
Your second chapter, it essentially poses the question, what is a dynasty? And, rather than just going to the dictionary, you try to lay it out for us, what you think a given great NBA team must have or must demonstrate in order to be called, in your context, a dynasty. Explain to our listeners what those kind of three different kinds of hallmarks are.
Well, I thought it was important to not just sit here and say who's in and who's out, right? Because all of this is subjective, right? We can swap these out, and, you know, a lot of the conversation in the sun, if you just don't have a standard, it just doesn't make any sense. But I knew some great teams would not be in this mix, because it's like, yo, we have 10 slots. We want you to pick 10. And I'm like, uh-oh, But so I just knew I had to come up with something. So I created like a rubric for my own sanity. Like one, you had just had to be really successful. It wasn't enough to just win a title. In some cases, it wasn't enough to win two. But you had to do something that was so like so incredibly successful, it set you apart even from the really good teams or the great teams. So that was bar number one, which eliminated a lot of teams. I did focus a lot on how this particular dynasty that was under investigation, how did it evolve the game? How did their play, their greatness, whatever, influence basketball after it? Because I do think that is critical when we're talking about these dynasties. Is if it was a real dynasty, then the game wouldn't be the same after having them. And to me, that was a really important measuring stick. And probably not usually factored into these basketball discussions, I gave weight to the dynasties that were relevant culturally, because I do feel like the NBA has always been in this space where they reflect or influence society. It's only five players per team on the court. You can develop a relationship with them. You can get to know who they are, their mannerisms. There's just a lot about them that you can they just can become part of your house in a way like TV anchors do. So I feel like it's important to recognize and acknowledge the dynasties that just let you know about the times that was going on, right? That let you know what was happening in the world, or somehow made themselves relevant in the world around them. I did give a lot of credence for that. And my final kind of separator was, who are the dynasties that we still talk about that we can't let go of, right, that somehow or another have survived time, and maybe perhaps even they weren't as good or weren't, you know, clearly better than another team, but something about them just stuck, and we can't let them go. So that was my rubric that I came up with to justify how I was going to leave off some of these great teams. And that's mostly what I was concerned about. A lot of these teams are duh. Of course they're out here. But then you get down to the bottom, there's a bunch of great teams. It's like, how am I going to explain to this particular market fan base that I left their team off? So I needed to create something.
We're speaking with Marcus Thompson II about his book Dynasties, which explores the legacy of 10 of the greatest NBA teams of all time. One thing that I found interesting about these various dynasties that you explore, 10 in all, is that in many of the chapters, although not all of them, there will be a section that will be called The Forgotten Star. And of course, this is where we're talking about somebody in a given dynasty that is not Michael Jordan or not LeBron James or not Giannis, but somebody who played a really critical role. Can you explain why you wanted to do that and maybe give our listeners your single favorite example of a forgotten star in a given dynasty?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that while the NBA is so star-driven, none of these players get to these heights without the players around them, right? I think Scottie Pippen is on a media tour right now trying to make sure that is very well understood. Like, as much as we love Michael Jordan, he wants people to know, man, that this is because of me too. And also, I definitely wrote this book with young basketball junkies in mind, right, or developing basketball junkies. And I think it's good for them to know who those other players are, because it's easy to have a conversation about Giannis, but I just wanted a young basketball mind to know, hey man, Jrue Holiday was so central to winning that title, right? Like, he might not be the most popular guy or the most well-known guy, but they don't win a title without Jrue Holiday. So I liked looking at those guys. I liked, you know, giving them essentially that platform where, you know, they could be remembered, because a big part of this was, you know, kind of remembering remembering who these legends and these like long time great teams that people have loved forever. So I feel like we kind of had to pay attention to them. My favorite, I'm trying to be sure if I mentioned him. My favorite underrated player was Sam Jones. Did I say Sam Jones?
I don't think so. Go ahead.
Sam Jones was really good, and I don't think enough people know about him. He was such a fine player that Russell thought he was. Sam Jones. I thought I did. Yeah, Sam Jones. He was as good as Havlicek. He was better than Cousy. He was incredibly central to their success. In many ways, he was the guy who took the last shot for them. Russell said, like, he wanted, like, if he had to give somebody the ball at the end of the game, it was Sam Jones. He had a lot of clutch shots. In the same way that Jerry West is known for being clutch at the end of games, like, Sam Jones was their guy for that. And I think he was just so incredible, and I don't think a lot of people know who he is. He played just with such giants that he kind of gets lost in the shuffle. So people like that who, you know, and his story is incredible. He didn't even want to go to the Celtics. He almost quit basketball and went to go teach because he got drafted by the Celtics. And he's like, man, I can't play for that team. I'm never going to play. They're so good. And he ends up being one of the stars. So to me, Sam Jones, when I walked away from this book, I was like, wow, we really don't know about Sam Jones. So he was kind of the impetus for it, to be honest.
Another interesting facet of many of these chapters is when there'll be a section that will say how the dynasty almost ended early. And again, this is not always there, but it's quite often there. It'll be these moments when everything that's going so well suddenly nearly goes off the rails. Can you choose your favorite example of that, of a dynasty almost coming to a premature end?
I got to go with the Showtime dynasty because I was talking to Alex English, and I was talking to him about the Lakers, and I just wanted to get his perspective as a player during that era. I wanted to get his perspective on just how good were they. And his whole tone was, man, if I didn't break my thumb, and we were going to beat them, and they weren't going to win. And so I'm like, I go back and look it up, and I'm like, you know what? He's right. Denver gave them all kind of problems, and they had them on the ropes, and then he broke his thumb, and he was out for the rest of the series, and the Lakers ended up winning. And he's fully convinced. If he doesn't get hurt, the Lakers don't win, and he's like, yo. And then at that point, are they a dynasty if they don't win the championship that year? Because they had won one, but not two. So that was my favorite just because it was so entertaining hearing this player from that era like still kind of still smarting over the fact that he was so close to taking down the Showtime Lakers, right? He was right there, and he felt it. And in that era, Denver was a low-key threat because they were actually the highest-scoring team in the league. Showtime Lakers gets a lot of credit because they won the championships, but they also played defense. They weren't as great offensively, but they played defense. Denver didn't play any defense, but nobody could score with Denver. They were juggernauts of offense back then. I mean, like 159, it was nothing to them. So they almost really outraced the Showtime Lakers until Alex English got hurt. That's my favorite one.
And, of course, just about every chapter includes a section in which you look at the villain in that particular dynasty story and also the face of the dynasty in which, you know, we'll really learn more about that key marquee player that is so central to a team's success and to their identity. And in many cases, you're kind of telling us things that we've never maybe considered before about what makes a given player so sort of so surpassingly great. And you have sections in just about every chapter in which you talk about the home court, that is, those places where a given dynasty is sort of centered and where they play their home games and sort of the special electricity that is in the air. Can you give your favorite example of that?
I think this is so important, and I worry about us losing it with these billion-dollar stadiums that are kind of like losing their personality. My favorite example, the Showtime Lakers going in Boston, and it's a hot day in Boston, and the Boston Gardens have no AC. And it is a sweltering palace. They have oxygen masks on the sideline. The Lakers are convinced that they turned the heat up in there, that they brought these fans. And Boston, which we could all probably acknowledge are much more like ready for weather adversity, are just like, yeah, let's go. And they were convinced that these Hollywood L.A. players could not handle it. And Larry Bird was like, I got this. Like, we can beat these guys in this. So they're watching Kareem Abdul-Jabbar with the oxygen mask on the sideline. And everybody's full of sweat. And the Boston crowd is loving it. They're going crazy. They see the advantage, and they're, like, kind of milking it. And just that, where the arena was a characteristic, in a sense, that represented the area it was in, that represented the disposition of the city and the team. Like, you know, it was tough to play in the Boston Gardens, because Boston is tough, because the people are tough, right? Like, and that kind of personality that these arenas had, to me, is an incredible part of the story. I hope we don't lose it with these, like, billion-dollar behemoths that all have to be kind of fancy and the same. But, I mean, like, you know, come on, Deer Valley in the finals was like, I don't care where you were in the country, you were like, yo, I really kind of want to be in Deer Valley right now. So, and you can't create, like, you can't just create this stuff somewhere. It has to be born by the people who are the fans of the team. Like, they create the situation. And that was especially true in the older days of the NBA. So, yeah, that the sweltering heat, it was like 85 that day in Boston, but it felt like it was 120 on the court. And Larry Bird is looking at them like, we got them. They're done. Look at them. But Boston, they were fine with it. They were like, "Yeah, it's hot. All right, we're good. We know what hot summers are like. Let's go."
30 seconds. What about the Milwaukee Bucks? Do you see the start of a new dynasty there?
Oh, absolutely. Because Giannis is that, like, Giannis. You know, you said the face of the franchise. That's piece one. Can you imagine if somehow they could win this title again this year, especially with you start throwing in these curveballs? We already had one, right? Brooklyn is the obvious favorite, but they don't even have one of their best players because he's not playing. So a lot of these unsettled elements, you know, Philly, another contender, doesn't have Ben Simmons. So, like, you tell it that anybody saying Giannis can't pull this off is crazy. But so that would be two and back-to-back. And I think he's going to turn Milwaukee into a destination. You can't tell me that next year, the year after that, some of these stars are going to say, I want to go play with Giannis, because that's how it happens. And then they go play with Giannis. And if he gets another great player, I do think that becomes a hot spot. I can fully see Giannis turning Milwaukee into a dynasty. And that would be, to me, it would be incredible, because one of the most overlooked teams, and it was tough to leave them off, was the Oscar Robertson Milwaukee Bucks with Lou Alcindor. And I do think people don't realize how good they were. And Kareem went on to create this grand legacy with the Lakers. But man, people forget how good he was with the Bucks during that window after the Celtics, where it's like the 70s, where, you know, kind of a new team won it every year. The Bucks were in that mix with the Knicks, with the Portland Trailblazers, with the Celtics, you know, with the Seattle Sonics. Like, there was a lot of really good teams with a lot of really good players, and the Bucks were there. So to me, it would almost be completing what they started, and it would be fitting to have that team, because they were so on the cusp of being a dynasty until Kareem won it out. But yeah, I can totally see Giannis doing this. He is exceptional, and he just needs one more player. He's doing this against teams with 2 and 3 superstars. So
right.
He needs one more player.
And I should mention that your book ends with a really compelling chapter called The Near Dynasties, in which you talk about some of these teams that came so close to deserving the name Dynasty. And Dynasties, again, is the title of your book published by Black Dog and Leventhal Publishers. Marcus Thompson II, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was great to talk with you, and I loved your book.
Thank you so much. Excellent conversation. Man, you must have a great show because those questions were really good. And let me tell you, I've done a lot of interviews, and the questions aren't always really good.
Well, I'm glad you had some good questions today. You had great answers. Thanks again for being on The Morning Show.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You're listening to The Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're sticking with basketball for part two as I replay for you a 2005 conversation I recorded with Gary Pomerantz about his fascinating and entertaining book called Wilt 1962, The Night of 100 Points and the Dawning of a New Era. It chronicles the towering achievement of Wilt Chamberlain on March 2, 1962, when he scored 100 points in a single game. This is still the record for the most points scored by a single player in an NBA game. Unfortunately, this game was not televised, so there is no film whatsoever of this game. And that was one of the challenges facing Gary Pomerantz in researching it.
What I discovered during my 3 years of research was that hardly anyone knew anything about it. This game, for all of its legend, has been almost like a sunken galleon resting on the ocean floor, just waiting to be recovered. And part of the mythology of the game is, as you say, that it was not televised. None of the New York press even bothered to show up because the season was nearly over and the Knicks were a last-place team. The Philadelphia Inquirer, a fine newspaper, didn't even send its correspondent to the game only 90 miles from the newsroom. And so all that exists from the coverage of that game is, you know, the scant media accounts, but also a bootleg copy of the fourth quarter play-by-play call of WCAU radio in Philadelphia. And that only really, it sort of come into existence in pieces over the years, but the entire fourth quarter was taped by a young fan in Amherst, Massachusetts. He was a big basketball fan. In fact, he broadcast the games of his school on the school radio station. And when he realized the import of what was happening here, he taped it, and thank goodness he did, because that tape has become like the Zapruder film of this game. You know, as Abraham Zapruder caught the Kennedy assassination in Dallas 18 months later, here was a tape really unearthed in about 1991 that really has answered a lot of questions about how it happened, how it unfolded in that fourth quarter against the Knicks and Hershey.
Amazing. You, of course, talk in this book about more than this incredible game. You also talk about this incredible athlete named Wilt Chamberlain and give this game, of course, some valuable context. One of the things you do at length is talk about what made Wilt Chamberlain such an extraordinary figure in basketball. And you say that right off the bat, he was perfection when it came to both body and ego.
Yes, I mean, you know, you can find now the shorthand summary of Wilt's life in two numbers, 20,000 and 100. You know, the 20,000, of course, comes from his boast late in life that he had slept with 20,000 women, and the 100 comes from the 100-point night in Hershey. And, you know, Wilt died 5 years ago of a heart attack at the age of 63 at his home in Bel Air in Southern California. And he was afflicted with a Goliath syndrome. He had this nearly obsessive need to prove his greatness in all things, big and small. And so the same need or impulse to score 100 points in a game in 1962 at the age of 25 to bend not only the Knicks, but really an entire sport to his will, transformed decades later into the need to create a myth-maker's boast of sexual conquest, 20,000 women. And you know, needless to say, one number can be proven, the other number cannot.
You call Wilt Chamberlain a one-man revolution, and a little later in the book you quote basketball great Oscar Robertson saying that Wilt Chamberlain single-handedly saved the league. Let's talk about that second quote. In what way is that true?
Well, it's really true in two ways. Wilt Chamberlain entered the NBA in 1959, and when he entered the league, it was still largely a white man's enclave. It was still pretty much a feet-on-the-floor, horizontal game, and Wilt changed the style. He led the movement that changed the style of play, more athletic eloquence, more speed, and certainly more self-expression. He took this game vertical. He took it above the rim and made it uniquely his. Think about 1959. The civil rights movement is taking flight in America. And there was unquestionably in the NBA during the 1950s and still into the early 60s a quota that limited the number of African-American players to initially one or two players per team and then three and four. And, you know, this was not written down and codified. It was understood. It was systemic in all of American culture. I think what Wilt Chamberlain did in 1962 by averaging 50 points per game that season against the league's best white players and by scoring 100 points in that game in Hershey was to symbolically blow that quota to smithereens.
Hmm. Let's talk about the game. And you, I mean, not the capital G game, I mean the game of on this night in March in 1962. You have mentioned the fact that at the time there was scant attention given to the game going in and some attention, of course, coming out of it, but probably nowhere close to proportion in terms of what really was accomplished that night. Explain what, if anything, remains sort of shrouded in mystery about that night, about exactly how that game was played. Are there important things that we do not know?
Well, yes. I mean, we don't know the play-by-play of the first three quarters. And, of course, the investigator in me was maddened by that. You know, I wanted to know everything that was knowable. What we have are you know, the Wilt statistics, his personal statistics from each quarter of that game. And of course, we have the full play-by-play from the fourth quarter. But again, the mythology of the game is such that it almost adds to it, you know. And you know, think about 1962. The nation is at a very different time. Kennedy and Khrushchev are locked in their Cold War showdown. And only 10 days before this game in Hershey, John Glenn had blasted into orbit. And he returned home with a great line. John Glenn said, "What can you say about a day in which you see four beautiful sunsets?" I mean, it was a time so distant that when Wilt Chamberlain scored his 100-point basket with 46 seconds to play, you have all of these kids, you know, running out onto the court. It was like a dam bursting, and the kids surging onto the court to congratulate Wilt. And, you know, the first boy to get to him, 14-year-old, reached out, shook his hand, and Wilt bounced the ball, and then the kids stole it. You know, and what's the joy to me about the story is not the theft, but just the idea that it was such a distant time that this boy could reach out and touch his fan. And
it's quaint.
Touch his hero. Yes, it is quaint. And you know, I mean, today we'd have security guards, we'd have policemen maybe on horseback, and we can't get near our heroes. So there was something really engaging and almost romantic about it. This game, to me, is trying to capture it is a little bit like trying to capture Franklin Roosevelt. You know, Americans didn't see him every day on TV, you know, but they heard his voice in those fireside chats. And, you know, their imagination was at play. This game has much that same quality.
Hmm. By the way, you mentioned the fact that Wilt Chamberlain was involved in an earlier game in which he scored 90 points, if I remember correctly.
Well, yes, that was not in the NBA. That
right.
was in high school in Philadelphia at Overbrook High School. And, remember, that was in only playing an eight-minute quarter. So in 32 minutes, you know, he's scoring 90 points.
And he sat out a little bit of the game.
Yes, he did.
And the final score, we should mention, is 123-21. So,
yes, it was not the kindest act ever committed by a player, a team, and a coach, I suppose. But, you know, his coach felt that, you know, he had talked to the athletic director at Overbrook High School and said, you know, what do I do? I've got Wilt Chamberlain, and you know, he can break all these records. What should we do? I don't want to embarrass teams. And the response from the athletic director at the school was, well, I coach the track team, and I don't tell my runners to slow down at the end. You know, cut them loose, and let's see what happens.
Hmm. As for this great game in 1962, you mentioned the fact that there is this bootleg recording of at least some of the fourth quarter radio broadcast. How helpful is that?
Well, it's very helpful. You know, by the way, your listeners might be able to hear it. They can hear it online at www.wilt1962.com. And it's really a fun tape. I mean, you can really, it puts you there, and you can feel the crowd, the smallness of it, and then you can feel the building excitement as Wilt gets closer to 100 points.
Hmm.
But you know, it was a very helpful piece of evidence for me as a, you know, in this game. But also, you know, I traveled the country and interviewed 15 of the surviving players from the two teams, the Philadelphia Warriors and the New York Knicks, from that night. And these men are now in their middle 60s to middle 70s. And some of their memories and their impressions from that night were invaluable. For instance, the young center who played against Wilt Chamberlain that night, Daryl Imhoff, now is at the U.S. Basketball Academy in Eugene, Oregon. And when I went to see him, there was an open basketball court there. And I said, Daryl, come over here and show me how you played against Wilt that night. Well, look, I mean, I'm 5'10 and a half. I'm not a great stand-in for the Big Dipper. But Imhoff showed me what he did and how he said, you know, Wilt used to lean back into him, and Imhoff was standing behind Chamberlain down low. And he said, you know, it forced me to recoil. He was so strong and so big, I felt like a tree was about to fall on me.
Hmm.
And Imhoff, of course, is 6'10". I said, well, what did you do? And he showed me how he positioned his feet, keeping Wilt Chamberlain from being able to turn in towards the basket for a dipper dunk. And he said, you know, when Wilt leaned back, what I would do is I would take the point of my right elbow and I would put it here, and he put it right between my shoulder blades. And I'm here to tell you, Greg, all this time later, Daryl Imhoff can still inflict pain with that elbow because it hurt. It hurt. And one of the many misconceptions about the game is that the Knicks didn't care. Well, they did care, and they cared mightily. I mean, this was the ultimate indignity to give up 100 points to a player. And so they were surrounding him with three and four players at the end of the game. The regular flow of the game broke down. Wilt's teammate, the rookie Tom Mascheri, told me it's the only time in his lengthy NBA career that he remembers being in a game where he would pass the ball and then stand there and watch.
Hmm. You mentioned that Wilt Chamberlain did not boast of this 100-point game. In fact, you said not ever, which is extraordinary when you, you know, given what you tell us about Wilt Chamberlain and his desire to achieve this kind of greatness. Can you explain that to us, how he would not boast about such an amazing feat?
It sounds hard to believe because Wilt Chamberlain boasted about just about everything. And yet there was something about this game, and I think it was that he took 63 shots from the field, 36 of 63 shots from the field, and miraculously he made 28 of 32 free throws that night, shooting them underhanded. And, you know, Wilt, in the locker room after that game, told his teammate Al Attles that he just couldn't believe he took 63 shots. And Al Attles said, what's the matter, big fella? You made more than half of them, 36. I think that's okay. And Wilt was afraid that this game would feed the notion that he cared only about his statistics, only about scoring and not about winning. And so he liked to talk more about his 1960 performance against the Celtics' Bill Russell, when he pulled down a record still of 55 rebounds. And it wasn't until near the end of his life that Wilt really began to embrace the 100-point game. He came to realize what an achievement it was. And, you know, we're a nation that loves offense. We love scoring. And so when he walked down the street, of course, people noticed and stared because he was just such a remarkable physical specimen. But he also began to realize that people would point at him and fathers would tell their sons, whispering, there's the guy who scored 100 points in a single game.
Gary Pomerantz is the author of Wilt 1962, The Night of 100 Points and the Dawning of a New Era, published by Crown. Since this interview is 16 years old, I thought I should do some research and make sure that nobody had broken Wilt Chamberlain's record in the intervening years. The closest that anybody has come is the great Kobe Bryant, who scored 81 points. So Wilt Chamberlain's towering record still stands. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we are excited to welcome into our studios not only Dr. Peter Dene from the music faculty at Carthage College, but one of the country's most esteemed choral composers, Rollo Dilworth, who is a special guest of Carthage for a special treble Chorale Festival that's going to be occurring on campus tomorrow, which will involve the treble chorale at Carthage as well as some area high school ensembles as well. That will be tomorrow's